Well, I was rewriting the sermon as we sang our last hymn. God's going to trouble the waters and wade in the waters. And waters are trouble and have been since pre-biblical times. Water's been controversial and difficult. And human beings are ambivalent about it. When you look at the Bible and pre-biblical creation stories, you'll see that in a pre-biblical Middle Eastern creation story, God doesn't create the entire world in 6 days. God spends 5 days wrestling with the waters, because the waters are not passive. They're active and they're contentious. They're symbols of chaos and even death. And so conquering the water was a way of conquering chaos and death in terms of the fable form, the mythic form, the literary form. When you look at biblical miracles around water, they're not just happenstance magic acts. They're symbols of other things. The Red Sea is parted and the Israelites pass through. It's a birth story, birth through a wet canal from the darkness into the light. It's a miracle, again, of the controlling of life by controlling, at least metaphorically, water. When you look at the water miracle in the Exodus of Moses striking a rock and bringing forth water, this again is a sign of sustenance, of how much we human beings need water. When you look in the Gospels and Jesus one-upping Moses by saying, "He gave you water, I'm giving you wine," it's marketing, and historically it's been effective. Particularly since the Jewish option on wine was Montashevitz, not such a great marketing move. Then you have Jesus walking on the waters and calming the waters. All of these are about water being active and contentious and dangerous and symbols. Jesus says to his followers, "You will be fishers of men, saving them from a sea of sin." There's a certain ambivalence that desert people have about water. You need it or you die. You don't get that water, you're not going to stay alive. On the other hand, the water comes sweeping down the weds and you can drown. The Hebrews were a desert people. They weren't seagoing people. The Hebrews were not Phoenicians. The Hebrews did not become a seafaring people until they got to Long Island and later on to Marina del Rey. But for the first millennia, it was, "That's nice, I'll stay here on the desert, maybe we can make a golf course." Water has always had this kind of ambivalent relationship with human beings. We need it, we fear it. It is the stuff of life. It is what sustains us. Water, both as symbol and as reality, is what we are made of. Our water gets out of balance. Most of us know the statistic, whether it's real or not, we know it, that we're 80% water. And some of Ed's minerals thrown in. But our water gets out of balance, we lose our cognition. Our hearts go out of rhythm, and we die. The balance that we have in our lives, in all life, is dependent on water. Star Trek popularized the idea that we are carbon-based units. This was to differentiate us from presumably silicon-based units, because we don't process silicon, and life as we know it needs carbon and not silicon. I've been to Las Vegas, and I know a number of people who are clearly silicon-based units. And someday, as we do more making of chips and implanting chips for pacemakers and insulin pumps and to help in Parkinson's disease and other sorts of diseases, we may merge and become not simply water-based, carbon-based, but silicon-based. But for the moment, we and life as we know it is based on water. We need to have it. Without it, we die. Without it, life as we know it fades away. And yet we're so careless, so profligate with the water. We don't appreciate it. We fight over it. There's politics involved with water as a commodity, as again, as the Ralph Nader reading indicated. We fight about it in California, between Northern California and Southern California. When my first year in the ministry, which was in Northern California 40 years ago, which is why your 45 doesn't impress me that much, 40 years ago, the big controversy in Northern California was the peripheral canal and whether Southern California would steal their water. Of course, now I have a slightly different view of it from 400 miles south, but it's the same issue alive again because we are competing for water, north and south, city and suburb, agricultural and golf courses. We are trying to make deserts bloom, and we are trying to build houses, and we're trying to do lots of things, and they all depend on water. It's a commodity. We also go to war over it. Water is the big political issue, not simply here between North and South, but also between California and Colorado and Arizona. And also, we try to take as much water as we can out of the Colorado before it gets to Mexico. And we look at the Jordan River, and there was a report on NPR today that it's drying up. And the Dead Sea is retreating because the water is being used by the countries along the borders of the Jordan. And it is a very hot-button issue in the Middle East. And it will be around long after this 100-year affair that we've had with oil is consigned to the dustbin of history, and we found other ways of getting power and energy into our world. Water will still be the issue. The Jordan River was chilly and wide, but it is neither wide enough nor deep enough to be wasted. And it is a hot point and a flash point. Water is also, as you all know, it's one of the issues of pollution, of how we live. And this is what I promised Jim, eventually a Central City sewer sermon. We have been careless with our water, with what we put into it. We as human beings have been careless with our oceans, what we put into it. They were so big, so deep, so wide, we thought, like global warming, that nothing we could do could really make a difference. But it did, it has, it will, and it is dangerous, and it is important. Because we do not have seven seas. We have only one sea, all joined. We have, truly, only one water. Whether it starts and an Arctic melts down and goes into the ocean, comes up as water vapor, turns into rain, rolls down a mountain carrying with it natural minerals and salt, but also the effluence of the affluent into the seas. And now the political issue, the pollution issue, is with the third world. One of the reasons the United States has not signed on to various treaties to restrict both air pollution and water pollution is, well, if India won't sign on and China won't sign on, it's not fair. And India and China say, look, you industrialized, pouring smoke into the skies, pouring garbage into the rivers and into the seas, and now you want to forbid us. That doesn't seem fair. Well, okay, I understand it doesn't seem fair. But we also industrialized on slavery, on war, and on colonialism. And I would not accept the argument that the third world gets to do slavery, colonialism, and war in order to industrialize. We are in this together. Globalization is not a political choice. We are in one world where borders and passports do not control pollution. They don't control what goes in the water because our smoke goes to Canada and acid rain falls on their trees and the smokes from 1,000 a million little fires in Africa go into the air, poisoning them first, and then taking a trip around the world without a passport. The same is true of the smoke and the pollution that comes out of Asia. It's all part of one world, and even if it looks like there is an advantage to one nation over another in the short run, in the medium run, we are in this together. We will breathe the same air as Asia. They will breathe the same air that we do, and we will drink the same waters. There are no borders. We have no separate long-term destiny from the rest of the world. So how can we begin to protect and to defend the waters? How can we begin to take some responsibility for what it is we do? And I think it begins by accepting, not denying, the amount of power that we have. Not necessarily on an individual level when the question comes up, what can I do, and there are things individuals can do, but for people who want to deny global warming, it's not helpful. Whether or not, whatever our role is in it, several things are clear. The ice caps are melting. That's going to make some changes in the world. Sea levels are going up. Climates do change. Once upon a time, North Africa was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Once upon a time, Greenland was green. The issue for all of us is when do we become green? When do we do not what we know is going to work, but what we believe can make things better? Because there is no downside to being green. There is no downside in appreciating how precious the air is, how precious the water is, how related we are one to another. That epiphany, that knowledge of connectedness, doesn't have a downside. It gives us the sense that we are all on this spaceship Earth together, doing what we can, with uncertain results. Yes, climates change, but there are things that we can do. Yes, sometimes the information is confusing and we can get into nice side debates on things. My favorite headline from last week was a story about page 8 or 9 of the New York Times that said, "Global warming fending off ice age." I go, well, there's a wash. The world is going to change. Patterns will change. Seas will rise. You might have some very nice oceanfront property down on Commonwealth, or if we combine it with an earthquake, maybe Las Vegas, and Silicon floats, so you know it might be okay. But we really need to understand how connected we all are. As we sit in this room and we breathe in the same air, as we are going to go into, and I don't mean to panic us here, into flu season, and I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say swine flu in here, but and go into swine flu season, I think swine flu is banished from this part. As we go into as we go into that season, we are all very aware from time to time of just what the vaporous connections that we have one to another. But remember the good parts. Remember how connected we all are to that ancient pre-biblical sea from which we came. What's astounding in the Bible is how right it gets it. Life begins in the waters and crawls out onto the land. Plant and animal and human, and finally human being. We carry that ocean in us. The salts and minerals from that ocean are in our blood and in our tears. When we dry each other's tears, our baby's tears, with kisses, we taste the salts of the ancient seas. When we bleed the salts and the minerals of ancient seas. When we look at our world, we must understand our connection from past to present to future, and with each other as we share this one precious globe. We're not going to get another one within the lifetime of anyone here Mars is out there, but we're not going, as they say on TV, anytime soon. Our salvation here for our children, our grandchildren, will be in taking care. And it begins by knowledge of how interrelated we are. And it continues with the small personal choices that we make. Last week, I talked about how much I love philosophically the great philosophical issues. But the little micro issues are of tremendous importance, not simply with the ultimate repose of my soul, but the repose of my head on a pillow tonight, and how my heart beats, and how I sleep, and what dreams may come on this coil. There are great issues and political issues to get involved with, to march, to picket, and I'm all in favor of those. But there are the small issues where we begin with ourselves, with our choices, by the footprints that we leave as we tread on this precious earth. It isn't somebody else out there only. It starts, as religion does, with how our values, informed by our hearts and heads, find expression in our hands, our feet, our choices. Feel powerful in our choices to make small but good differences in each other's life and in the life of this planet and in the future of this precious world that we share together today.